So good morning, and thanks for being here this morning. Soil health, we hear a lot about soil health these days, and the biggest question, at least for the people that I'm involved in, is how do you measure it? You know, what is it? How do you measure it? And if you ask a bunch of scientists, you often get one consensus, and that's soil organic matter, although people quickly point out not organic matter, but organic carbon, and by dry combustion. So there's always some caveats. And then you might get a near consensus on aggregate stability, depending upon which method you use, of course. But beyond that, there's really very little consensus on soil health, particularly when you start to talk about soil biology. So soil biology, we know soil organisms provide many functions that contribute to soil health, growth of plants, the sustainability of agricultural production systems. We know there's quite an array of things. What we still are grasping at is how to measure their role in increasing the soil health and thus the sustainability of agricultural production systems. And what we really want, not just us, but a lot of people really want an assay that responds in a relatively short term. And by that, I don't mean a week or a day, but I mean a year or two. Some time frame that's relevant to an agricultural producer and a rancher, relevant in terms of the time scales that they make decisions on, or another landowner. We simply have to do our best to try and find some measure that helps them make decisions, because that's the request that we're getting loud and clear. And this test, of course, has to be all the things you want tests to be. You know, it's got to be easy and quick and cheap and all that stuff. And I put portable there, and portable to me means it doesn't take a supercomputer and a team of researchers 3 years to describe one site. And so that's what I mean by portable. And so why are we doing this? There are a number. I mean, it seems like every day I see a new one. Did anybody see the report by the Nature Conservancy that was released November 1st? They were in such a hurry, there's typos on every page. It's really, really quite interesting. But and then the FFR meeting on, was it Wednesday morning, I believe. Incredible amount of interest from our stakeholders as either agricultural scientists or soil scientists or soil microbiologists. Unbelievable amount of interest and money, and these folks are recapturing the momentum in soil health that was started probably in the early 90s, kind of petered out, but now I think there's critical mass of interested parties. And more importantly, there's a critical amount of funding that we should feel compelled to continue searching for the answers to their questions, even though, frankly, I just want to say I don't know more than half the time. So measuring soil microbes, you can measure a lot of things. You can look at cell numbers and their change, or biomass and their change. You can look at who's there. You can look at what the relative abundances are, or you can look at activities. And to me, activities are most strictly a change in reactant or product over time. Usually we think of mineralization activities, but you can also apply it to any kind of redox reaction, say ammonium oxidation, or some depolymerization of macromolecules. What's really, I find, interesting is all these things that we measure and we call something cell number, biomass, or activity, we really don't measure anything directly with a high degree of confidence. The only thing in that list that I've ever measured directly is cell number by physically counting them. And I know the number I counted was nowhere near what the actual number is in the soils. For anybody who's ever done that, you'll know why. And the other interesting thing I find is we often use activities to infer the other things. We use activities as a surrogate for biomass. We use activities to measure fungal bacterial ratios. We use activities for all kinds of things. And the expectation is that all these things are correlated. But there's work that goes back 35 years that shows in a lot of oligotrophic natural systems like soils, the expectation shouldn't be that they're all correlated. Sure, if you're in a bioreactor or a wastewater treatment plant, they're going to be correlated. But in an oligotrophic system, maybe not. But I focused on activities also because many of these activities also relate to functions of practical concern with soil health in terms of nutrient provision or decomposition. So that's why I focused on activities for this particular study. So our study objectives were to determine if an interseeded cover crop mixture could substantially increase soil microbial activities and thus nutrient cycling and soil health. And then the secondary objective was to identify activity-based measures that reflect ag management effects. And we used fluorescein diacetate hydrolysis, short-term carbon mineralization, basal respiration, substrate-induced respiration, and potentially mineralizable nitrogen. So here's our field site. We have about a quarter section of land in Brookings, South Dakota. This experiment was started in 2014. So what I'm trying to look at in this experiment is can we measure short-term effects? So a year or 2 years. We know some of these things work on 20 or 30-year-old long-term experiments to resolve the treatments. But can we do this on a scale that's relevant to a producer? Four blocks, it's all corn, soybean. Anybody who lives in the Midwest knows that that's a very common rotation. And we think it's significant because direct drilling cover crop mixtures into a corn soybean rotation is probably the best entry point to promote adoption of cover crops in the northern climes where corn and soybean are the predominant rotation. So we drill the cover crop mixture probably a month or so after the cash crop emergence. At no time is the ground completely barren of a living plant. And so that's the system we're working in. Here's pictures. On the left is corn. On the right is soybean. And these are from fall of 2014, the first year. And you can see the interseeded cover crop. And again, it's a mixture of six or seven things. And what you might mostly see is rye and maybe a little clover and slender wheatgrass. And then in the spring of 2015, before we planted the cash crop, before we planted the cash crop, that's the lower panel, so you can see the extent of growth we're talking about. It's not a uniform cover crop mixture, but yet there's something growing. Interesting, this is a picture from a couple weeks ago. This is in the corn, and you're like, hey, that's not the same cover crop. Well, it's a mix, and every year when you plant a mix, something different comes up. And something different wins. And this year it looks like the radishes won and some turnips won and maybe a little bit of clover. So every year is something different, but the important thing again is we're trying to just have something growing at all times. So the first assay I want to show you the data for is short-term carbon mineralization. We used basically Allen's method but we use 24 hours. This is dried soil. It's re-wetted. You look at the CO2. In this case, we used gas chromatography. We looked at three depths. And in the soybean, this test was able to differentiate the cover crop effect in either no-till or till. But in corn, we weren't able to discriminate the effect at all. And this same pattern was observed at the deeper depths, 15 to 30. And 30 to 60. So then we looked at fluorescein diacetate hydrolysis, also on these same samples from 2014, and we weren't able to discriminate either cover crop or tillage effects with fluorescein diacetate, which measures, it's kind of a generic enzyme, lipases, esterases involved in decomposition of organic matter. We weren't able to see that cover crop effect at any depth. We did the same thing in 2015. Also no effect. And I changed the depths to 0 to 10, 10 to 30 that year in 15. And we're continuing with those depths right now. But we did not see an effect with FDA. And then I started working with basal and substrate induced respiration, and I did this assay in samples collected August of 2014, and I call these intact mini cores. You take a little core, and we only did these in the no-till plots, and bring it into the lab and inject it with either water or glucose, and then pop it in a gas-tight jar and measure the CO2 that's evolved. So it's an intact basal respiration. And basal respiration, we couldn't distinguish the treatments. Again, these are all no-till. We didn't see any effect of cover crop. But with the substrate-induced respiration, we did get an effect of cover crop in soybean, but not in corn. Well, this is kind of labor-intensive, and you got to take a lot of those little cores in each plot. So I only did it once, and now I'm just kind of waiting to see what I want to do next on that. We looked at PNM, potentially mineralizable nitrogen, with the 7-day anaerobic method, again, two depths, and this was fall 2015, and we weren't able to resolve the cover crop or the tillage effects. I was a little disappointed, but I think maybe it just takes longer for this method. And then I used the more conventional basal and substrate-induced respiration, where you use disaggregated soils instead of the intact mini-cores, and I did it on the tillage and the no-till. And I not only used basal and substrate-induced with glucose as kind of a surrogate for plant exudate-type substrates, but I also used phenol as a surrogate for soil organic carbon. Again, I'm just showing the top depth, 0 to 10, soybean and corn, and this pattern was repeatable for all depths, all samples, all treatments, with the phenol and the basal respiration. We couldn't see any resolution of the treatment effects under no-till conditions. With the glucose substrate induced respiration method, we were able to see increased activities and no-till at any depth with that, and the patterns were very reproducible. So then I got to looking at all the data together, and one of the things struck me was how each method changed with depth. And with FDA, we couldn't resolve the treatments in the surface soils, right? So this is an average of all treatments, all crops, prorated per 100% of the shallow sample. And FDA drops right off. It's very sensitive to depth in our system. Potential carbon mineralization, slow decline, but we were able to detect the cover crop effect with that. And then in 2015, I got the very similar situation where FDA is so sensitive to depth, and SIR with glucose, which helped us discriminate the cover crop treatments, is much less sensitive to depth. So I think this is a phenomenon that points out that all these assays are measuring different things, and I really don't think we know exactly what they're measuring and when to use one in which case. And so some of this work dates back 30 or 40 years, people were doing that, and we still haven't got to the point where we can answer the practical questions that are being imposed on us by stakeholders today. So that's where I'm at with this. We're going to continue this experiment for 5 years. We've been added another sampling point this year, 2016. And so I would like to conclude from this data that two of the measures were able to discriminate the cover crop effect, and that would be the short-term carbon mineralization and the glucose substrate-induced respiration. And two, that each one is measuring something different, and to scale this, you're going to have sample density concerns. But I think the frequency we saw in the first talk, the difference between treatments that you might see if you collected samples in June, July, and August and September, and I think that's going to be really important. And then how shallow can you go and get a representative sample, and how's that going to be affected by residues and tillage? And so I think those are really important points to consider as we go forward. So thank you.